It's a control drain machine.
All right.
So that's just one to Dallas Philosophers Forum debate. The possibility of free will in human action. Can you blame me? An event co-sponsored with SMU. I'm Rob Olson, a director with the group, and I want to thank everyone for coming out this evening in this heat. What is it, about 104 degrees, 105 degrees out there? I was mentioning to our panel, talked to an acquaintance of mine. He was in Anchorage. It was 50 degrees and raining. That sure sounds very, very good. An event such as this entails a great deal of work, and I just want to recognize several other members of the Dallas Philosopher Swarm for their efforts. First is our president, David Drum. If you can raise your hand, David, who's provided great overall leadership for this debate. At the end of today's debate, he'll have some parting comments, and we'll have a drawing for a series of speeches for our upcoming season. And then our treasurer, Jack Youngkin. Is Jack just outside, I guess? He's outside taking the money. I want to recognize him, and he helped out in arranging these facilities. In addition, Ken Sauter, he's our sound man and our webmaster and our email master, distribution list, does all sorts of great things, and we appreciate all of his work. Carla Kraft, back here, another director who... takes our notes in our meetings and keeps us on track on various projects we're involved in, various assignments, and also has helped out on audio issues. Lawrence Bookway, another director, is in charge of our, Lawrence, raise your hand, in charge of our college and university relationships. We also have a director emeritus, Bob Berman. He's been, how long, when did you first get started with the Dallas Philosopher's Forum, Bob?
About 1981 or 2,
and has been a director emeritus for many, many years. So we've been around many, many years. And I also want to thank Dr. Steve Serdlich for his moderating tasks and arranging the venue for this event. Our thanks to SMU for this co-sponsorship as well. For those of you unfamiliar with the Dallas Philosophers Forum, we're a not-for-profit organization that provides speakers, typically philosophy professors and religion professors from area colleges and universities. On the second and fourth Tuesday evening of each month from September through May, with charges for each lecture at $5. We meet at the L. Phoenix at Skillman and Audelia in North Dallas, and our first debate for the 2011-2012 year will feature Dr. Matthew Waltz of the University of Dallas. The title of his speech is A Kingdom of Ends or Friends, Reflections on Kant's and Aquinas' Moral Worlds. Other talks will entail Plato's Symposium and Hindu philosophy. In addition, we have a website that has much of the same information, www.philosophersforum.org. Please feel free to forward this link on to others and let them know about Dallas Philosopher's Forum. And before we begin, please turn your cell phones off or put them on vibrate mode at this time. And now I'd like to introduce our moderator and two debaters. As mentioned, our moderator is Dr. Steve Serdlich. Took me a while to learn how to pronounce that, but I think I'm getting it, Dr. Serdlich, Associate Professor and Chair of the Department of Philosophy here at SMU. Dr. Serdlich earned his PhD at Columbia University in 1981 and a BA cum laude at Harvard University in 1972. His research interests include work on ethics, action theory, moral psychology, and punishment. In 1991, Dr. Serdlich was recognized as a Rotunda Teacher of the Year. And in 2009, he received the Perrine Award SMU Phi Beta Kappa. Taking the positive position is Dr. Bruce McDonald with the sharpest, wildest shirt in the room. Dr. McDonald is Associate Professor of Religion and Philosophy at Texas Wesleyan University in Fort Worth, and we particularly thank him for driving all the way out here from Fort Worth for this event. He attended Asbury Theological Seminary, graduating with a Master of Divinity in theology. He then pastored United Methodist Churches in Vermont and upstate New York for 17 years before heading to Scotland for a PhD in ecclesiastical history at the University of Edinburgh. He has received the Gold Rule Award for outstanding teaching and also serves as organist at the Handley United Methodist Church in Fort Worth. Taking the negative position at the far end is Dr. Robert Howell. Dr. Howell is Associate Professor of Philosophy at SMU as well. He received his PhD from Brown University in 2002 and is the co-author of A Dialogue on Consciousness and The God Dialogues, both published at Oxford University Press. He has published numerous articles on the problem of consciousness and on self-knowledge and the nature of the self. He is a member of the Academy of Distinguished Teachers here at SMU. And now please join me in welcoming Dr. Steve Smerdlik.
Very complicated, and two mics, I'm terribly confused.
Yeah.
Well, this should be interesting. We have two great speakers tonight. I don't know about you, but I actually think that the problem of free will is about the deepest issue there is in philosophy. It's one where you can get great debates going, and they've been going since ancient Greece, so I think this will be fun. I have the easy job. I'm just kind of a timekeeper and the moderator. I won't run through the entire schedule of the evening, but Rob was good enough to think this through, and there's a whole structure that I'll try to follow. And it begins with each of our two speakers speaking for about 15 minutes. Bruce speaks in what's called the affirmative constructive. He will defend the position that human beings do have free will, at least up to a certain limited extent. And then Robert will speak on the negative side, negative constructive. That's a funny expression. He will be arguing that human beings do not have free will. In fact, he maintains that free will is not even possible. We couldn't have free will. That's an interesting position to take. So you don't want to listen to me. You want to listen to Bruce and Robert. And so I'll turn the microphone now over to Bruce for the affirmative constructive position on free will.
With the weather we've had, let me know when I'm running out of time. It's a good thing I speak rather quickly because I've got quite a few things here. With the weather we've had, I thought we might have discussed the possibility of hell, but we couldn't find anybody to take the negative position. We all have been there, done that. So at any rate, so I think probably free will works better. And I've sometimes been accused as a complete free will person, and as Steve has already mentioned, that's not quite the case because I believe there are certain limitations, but within those limitations, I do believe we have free will. I know once when I was living in Scotland, I went to a friend's house, and when I hit the buzzer, he says, "Is that Will?" I said, "No, it's Bruce." He says, "Oh, I mean free will." He was a devout Calvinist, you see, that seriously doubts the business of free will. Another time, I got there and he hit the buzzer. I said, "Who is it?" And I said, "John Wesley." And he said, "Go home." Well, anyway, but we were good friends in spite of that. Of course, we're going to find out, and Robert will be able to tell you later on, if many of you already know, that in the ancient world, there were those who strongly disagreed with the idea of freedom of will. One, of course, was the Stoic group. The idea was that our freedom comes in our reaction to the things that come across. But really, there are fates involved that we have no control over, but we do have control over how we react. And of course, today, many psychologists and psychiatrists would say that's a very valuable insight. And of course, today, there are scientists who say that everything is genetic. I don't know what angle Robert's going to take, but it wouldn't surprise me if he took that angle. Therefore, consequently, we can really not rise above our genetic structure, and therefore we really have no particular freedom. On the other hand, of course, there are those who deny freedom of will who take what I call the Flip Wilson attitude, "The devil made me do it." And we play the blame game. Many of you may be familiar with Leonard Bernstein's great musical there, West Side Story. And if you are, you may remember the song in it about G. Officer Krupke. And he's the guy that's always busting the Hispanic community. And they say that, you know, they talk about the problems they had. Their grandmother was into pushing heroin, etc. So it's no wonder we're a mess, you see, that sort of thing. So the blame game, I find, is something that we find today that a lot of people try to use to get out of accepting responsibility. Now, for the idea that we do have at least some free will, we find there are also some very fine philosophical speakers in the past there and writers. David Hume, for instance, certainly believed that we did have some freedom of will because he encouraged altruism, the idea that it's not all about me, but we should be concerned about the people around us. William James said that there were times when we may not have grounds for believing, but he found that people who believed in something definitely were better off, and he encouraged people to exercise their, dare I say it,
free will to believe in something like that. Likewise, the utilitarian said that when we are confronted with choices, we need to make that choice. And of course, Jeremy Bentham would say it is what makes the largest number of people happy. And John Stuart Mill would have taken the idea it's whatever seems to do the most good for the most people. But either way, it involved a choice on our part. I'm currently reading some of the work of John Locke, whom I appreciate very much. And he says, really, free will is not the argument. He says it's when we have liberty to make a choice. And he said, and I tend to agree with this, there are times when our liberty may be circumscribed to where we cannot make a free choice. For instance, suppose you have a person who is in military orders and would like to do something, but of course the powers that be won't let him. At that point, John Locke says, the person would not be able to exercise any so-called free will, although, as I say, he tends to debate the term. And I think certainly that Locke is on the right track there. So I think there are limitations to free will, and I am certainly not an absolute free will person, and certainly I believe, as one who teaches ethics, Steve would appreciate that, but our liberty stops where the next person's liberty begins. But within that area, I do think that we do have some area for freedom of choice. Now, it has already been mentioned that I was a Methodist minister in the frozen Northeast, which this summer is not frozen either, for 17 years. And certainly, as a minister there, I am one who believes that we had freedom of choice, and I was often encouraging people to make the right choice. What was discouraging was when I saw people, and Dr. Howell may disagree with this, deliberately make a wrong choice and know they were so doing, and then, of course, blaming everybody else for it there. Before my hair began to turn blonde, or polka dot, it had quite a bit of red in it, and you know what they say about redheads and temper, and there were times when that could be a temptation, I will say that. Now, also, when we talk about free will, I would say that even though I am speaking as a theist and as a Christian, I would not agree with some of the classic formulations like those of Augustine and John Calvin. Augustine was so concerned to stress the necessity of grace that he said that really we don't have that freedom of choice until we are in touch with Christ, and therefore the virtues of the pagans are really just splendid vices. Now, I have to admit, I have very little patience with him at that particular point, and of course, Calvin would have echoed that type of thinking during the Reformation. So again, I strongly disagree with that, because when we read of someone who may not have a faith background at all doing something wonderful merely because they want to help out, we sometimes feel very warmed by that sort of thing. So I think that that person definitely should be seen as doing something that is good, and that it is not just a splendid vice. So I do speak from a theistic angle, and for those of you who are familiar with the scriptures of the Old and New Testament, or Hebrew and Christian scriptures, there we find that definitely the angle of choice is laid before people right through, perhaps more clearly in the book of Joshua, when he says, I lay before you two choices, make your decision, etc., etc., and right on through. And we do find that in the New Testament, Jesus and St. Paul, for instance, both used arguments that were definitely encouraged to help people exercise some free will. Now, it's interesting to see that within the Christian community, there have been some, I've already mentioned Augustine and Calvin, who denied this. We would find, for instance, Tolstoy thought definitely that we should do away with the judicial system all the way around, because, after all, Matthew 7:1 says, judge not, lest ye be judged, and he, therefore, said Tolstoy, should do away with all of the judicial system. That, with me, is one of the problems that one sees when one denies free will completely. Because at that point, then why should we even have institutions of law, legality? Just a few minutes ago, I had to go out and move my car because I was out here in the angled parking, and I did not have an SMU sticker on there, and I did not want to pay through the nose for a ticket there, so I moved safely across the street. But again, here is this idea that our whole legal system is built on this idea, should we do away with it? I don't think we should, and I think that it is propounded on the idea that we do have some freedom of choice. There's other consequences of this, too, that no one, if we believe in non-freedom of choice, we don't believe that anyone can ever do anything different. We can never rise above our genetic structure. Now, as a case in point, one of my former students at Texas Wesleyan, a fine young fellow from West Texas, grew up in a family where the men grew up to drive trucks. Period. End of quote. It had been that way from the year one, and as it was in the beginning, is now and ever shall be. And Henry said, I want to go to college. And the basic idea was, well, who do you think you are, Mr. Big Bridges? You are going to grow up and drive trucks like the rest of your family. He disagreed. He came to Texas Wesleyan, very good choice, and finished years ago. He is now married to an obstetrician at Harris Hospital. They have a growing family and are doing great. But what do you want to bet that every time he goes back home, he gets flack from his family because he was too big for his britches? Likewise, when I was pastoring in Vermont, I had some people that the women in that family, it was said, do not go to high school. And the man that did this was something of a redneck, and rednecks are not confined merely to the south of our country, I'll tell you. His youngest daughter wanted to go to high school, but no, members of our family, the women, do not go to high school. The next generation came along, and the women went to high school. I'll bet Grandpa just about had 10 jillion fits, but the girls went to high school and survived. You see. So I think that, again, the idea that we can never do anything different is one of the things that is a consequence if we do not believe in freedom of will. And the fact that we can never rise above our genetic structure or do anything different, and yet the world is full of people who have done some things different, and even when they get flack from their families, they still do it. So I think we could all tell some stories about that, perhaps even in our own experience. So I am one who thinks that within limits we do have some freedom of will. It may be limited by the next person's freedom, and also there may be times, as John Locke would say, when we are not at liberty to exercise that, but I do believe that our choices make a vast difference, and consequently I like to encourage my students to think things through and make a decision accordingly. Am I out of time?
Give about 3 more minutes.
I said I talked fast. So I guess I'll stop there and give Robert a chance to make up for it with his arguments. So I just mentioned these things, and it's a basic summary of some of my particular stats.
So I get those 3 minutes?
Absolutely.
You are wrong. That's your privilege.
3 more minutes are wrong is good. So I'm said to be adopting the negative position here, and I got to tell you, you don't know how negative just yet. It is actually a pretty negative position, because not only do I deny the existence of free will, I deny that free will is even possible. And so I'm not exactly sure what Bruce and I agree on, but like, here's some things that I'm going to maintain. One is that probably determinism is true when it holds about psychology, human psychology. So that's the first thing. The second is that this threatens free will in the sense that we want it. The third thing that I want to maintain is that even if it turns out that determinism is false, that actually that's even worse, that we don't have free will or we don't have what we want either. Right? So one thing that I don't disagree about is I think that we do make choices. I just don't think that they're free choices. I don't think they represent free will, and I don't think they indicate something that actually deserves this sort of deep praise and blame that we think that, should be associated with free will. So first of all, to define the terms, what is determinism? For me, it's just pretty straightforward. To say that the world is deterministic just means that basically everything that happens was caused to happen. And it was caused to happen, in fact, by a prior state of the world that was sufficient for its occurring. That's all I mean by determinism. And that includes our choices. That includes everything that happens. One of the consequences of that view, that basically everything that happens, happens because of a cause, is that basically if you take the state of the world about 1 million years ago, and take the laws of nature and plug them all in, basically everything that happens follows. So every single shirt that we're wearing, even that one, is actually predicted by the state of the nature at the time 1 million years ago, plus the laws. And that strikes me as a surprising consequence, but it is a consequence of determinism, if determinism is true. Why does determinism threaten free will? Well, a lot of people just feel like they can just see that determinism threatens free will. It turns out that basically everything that you do was writ into the universe 1 million years before you were born. It looks like in some sense it wasn't up to you. I think that there's a lot of discussion that can be had about that, and philosophers do have that sort of discussion. For example, Locke is somebody who would disagree with that particular line of reasoning. But I'm going to kind of just leave it sort of intuitive at this point, but if it turns out that you can't change the past, right? You can't change what happened before, and you can't change the laws of nature, which determine the way the past affects the future, then in some sense, the future's not up to you, because everything just kind of unreels from things that are set that are out of your control. So that's where I see the threat coming from with determinism. Now, why do I think determinism is true? Well, I think that there's several sorts of reasons, and I should say that my claim that determinism is true is somewhat limited. Actually, I think that scientists indicate that it's probably not true on the quantum level, and we can talk about that, although I probably won't have very much intelligence to say about it. I think determinism is true when it comes to human psychology, basically, and I think we have an intuitive understanding of why that's the case. After all, how often is it that basically you look at somebody's behavior and say, there's absolutely no reason why they did that? Right? The fact is that people are pretty predictable, actually, and it's a good thing, too. If my wife were completely unpredictable, I would seriously regret having married her. Right? We actually want people to be kind of predictable, and in general, we do find that they are, and when they're not, we usually find that there was something else kind of under the hood going on that we didn't know about, some considerations that they had, some things that, you know, might not even have been conscious, or things that are just purely neural. Right? But in general, the more you learn about people, the more you're kind of able to kind of say, yeah, I see what sort of prefigured that action. I see that, you know, it's not just a pure accident, you know, that I didn't just jump out and kill a man, right? Because, you know, there's something about me and the way that I was raised. Whether it's genetic or environmental doesn't matter. There's something about me that's making it such that I'm not doing that. And, you know, I hope that you all are pretty good at predicting that that's the case in this particular instance. So I think that there's something intuitive about it there. I also think that there's something, some general scientific evidence to support it. And this is one of these cases where the scientific evidence is sort of supporting it in the absence. The fact is we just have absolutely no reason to believe that there is a lack of determinism in the level of our brains. Right? Our brains are composed out of basically the same sort of stuff that composes other things. And they're governed by the same sorts of chemistry, the same sorts of you know, laws that govern everything else. And it's not like once you actually kind of focus in and get close to brains, things go crazy, right? Things continue to work in a law-like fashion, right? And we have excellent evidence, actually, that the things that happen as a result of things that happen in our brains, right? So the lack of evidence for there being any sort of a deviation from the laws of nature when it comes to human beings, I think it's pretty suggestive. It looks like we're of a piece with everything else, and as such are governed by the same sorts of laws as everything else. So, I do think that we can actually point to a handful of things that are even more specific experiments, which I kind of want to present in a little more detail because I find them particularly interesting. I think we should be careful in interpreting these experiments, let me say in advance, but I think that you'll find them curious. So, these are experiments in neurology and in psychology, and they suggest the funny thing that basically the sense that we have of consciously making decisions is actually, in some sense, illusory, right? That actually, this moment when I'm trying to decide whether to go to the left or right of my podium looks like the most underdetermined thing in the universe, right? And boy, I just originated that action out of nothing. That sense, it turns out, may very well be flawed. So here's one interesting experiment, actually, that kind of brings this out. This was a guy named Delgado in 1969, did the following thing, which, you know, of questionable ethics perhaps, poked around in a guy's brain while he was laying there, and the guy's head would turn to the left and turn to the right, or turn to the left, turn to the right in a fairly predictable fashion when he stimulated. It's pretty clear after a couple days that this guy was turning his head because he was being poked in the head, right? And not like, you know, look over here. He was being poked in the brain in such a way that he turned. The funny thing is that when asked, he actually claimed to be making a conscious decision to be turning his head. He claimed to basically be deciding to turn his head and actually would provide rationalizations for why he did it. He said, I was looking for my slippers, or I was looking for the water, right? That's odd, right? That suggests that actually we can have the sense of making these sort of initial choices that are conscious willings that are themselves precipitated by something neural that we're not aware of. And that's slightly worrisome. There's another experiment that's a little more famous by Benjamin Libet in 1983. And he did the following. He actually had his subjects move their fingers, just decide, you know, move your finger at some point. And he had them hooked up in such a way that he was able to time when they consciously sort of were aware consciously deciding to move their finger. And he was able to kind of track what he thought was what brain activity there was going on, and he was able to kind of time the relationship between brain activity, the conscious willing, and actually moving of the finger. Interesting thing came up. About 500 milliseconds before the finger moved, there was what he called a readiness potential in the brain. There was activity in the brain which looked like it precipitated the movement. So far, not so surprising. We kind of expect that sort of thing. What's surprising is that the conscious decision to move the finger was only 100 milliseconds before the moving of the finger. 400 milliseconds after the brain activity, which looked like it was precipitating the movement of the finger. Which looks like our conscious decisions, what we think are conscious willings, actually lag behind the brain activity that gives rise to. Odd. Very odd. I have some worries about this experiment. I think that some philosophers have done some really good work to try to kind of tease apart, like, what's relevant here, what's not relevant here. A guy named Al Milley has done some really nice work, wrote a book on it. If you're interested in this, I really recommend it. But when I was kind of thinking about this experiment, I actually found, just today, an experiment that was performed in 2008 by Chun Soon and others. And this experiment was even more suggestive. Apparently, the setup of this experiment was that they had subjects have two buttons. You had a button on the left side, a button on the right side, and you could ask them to choose, you know, to hit whichever button, right? And these guys were in an fMRI. Well, what they found was, is that actually they could predict which button was going to be pushed based upon information in the brain. But here's the funny part. They could predict it like 9 seconds before the awareness of the conscious decision. Right? So they claim to be making the decision. They were able to kind of look at a clock and some things to determine when they made the decision. But they were able to predict, like, up to 10 seconds, it says, before they were conscious of making the decision, which button they would hit. So what does this tell us? Well, I think, again, we've got to be careful. It doesn't tell us that determinism is false, or determinism is true, I think. I mean, maybe there's, you know, something that's violating determinism somewhere else, but here's what I think it does tell us. If one of the senses that we have that determinism is false, that is, if one of the senses that we have, that free will, if that we have free will, is our conscious sense of willing, if that's our evidence for it, it doesn't look very good. Because it looks like that's downstream from unconscious neural activity, which actually fully predicts our actions. It looks like it fully determines our actions. So these are still feelings of choosing. And I think that it's still correct, actually, to say that the subject's making the decision. I think that the subject is deciding whether or not to go left or right. It's just that decision is fully determined by prior events. And some of those prior events we can actually trace with an fMRI 10 seconds before they even make the conscious effort to do one or the other. So I think that undermines some of our intuitive reason, actually, for bucking against the possibility of determinism. So let's see, where am I? I think that determinism is probably, looks pretty true for psychology. I think that's a threat to free will because if it turns out that basically our actions are written into the world before we were ever born, in some sense, in some really important sense, they're not up to us. Maybe it's our genetics, maybe it's our environment. It doesn't really matter, you know. But the fact is, it's something that preceded us. So, still, I've got to be humble here, right? I'm just a philosopher. Right? And even though philosophers look better when they throw scientific stuff into their talks, we're still just philosophers. And we don't enter labs very much, and are not very good at interpreting data. So I've got to be humble. Maybe it turns out that determinism is false about our psychologies. You know, maybe I'm wrong. Right? Maybe it turns out that these studies are false, and that somewhere along the line in the decision-making process, there's an undetermined event. There's something that is uncaused, right? Which is what seems to be required from escaping sort of the noose of determinism. Well, let's call that a choice. Let's say that that's that event, that thing that happens that is uncaused is a choice. To me, that's actually a lot worse than if it's determined. Because think about it. If the choice is not caused, then I didn't cause it. And if I didn't cause it, surely I can't be held responsible for it. Right? Inserting randomness into the universe and placing it among some sort of a path to my decision-making process looks like it actually robs me of responsibility rather than giving me responsibility. Because it actually makes crucial actions disappear out of my control as opposed to letting them remain things that, for example, flow from my character. I would much prefer it be the case that they flow from my character, which was formed by my environment and my genetics, than have it be the case that somewhere along the line there was some sort of a wheel of fortune between my character and my actions, such that my actions weren't called by me. That seems actually a much, much worse result. So the result is kind of a dilemma. And I think it's a really negative dilemma. The dilemma is that if determinism is true, it looks like we don't have free will. Because if determinism is true, then basically the things that we do, even though they seem like choices, are merely sort of unfoldings of cosmic events that preceded us by many, many years. Right? We play important roles in the process, but we don't actually sort of, it's not up to us how the process goes any more than it's up to the wheels where the car goes. Or determinism is false. That's another possibility, the other arm of the dilemma. If determinism is false, then there's uncaused events in my decision-making process, but I can't be responsible for things I didn't cause, so then I can't be held responsible for those either. Given that those are the only two possibilities, and both of them lead to the fact that there's no free will in the sorts we want, free will is impossible.
Well, we have reached the stage of the response. Bruce has 5 minutes now to respond to Robert.
You want me here or up there?
Up there.
Okay.
Usually my bellowing bass baritone can be heard fairly well without it, but we'll play it safe here, you know.
You will notice that the sound system acted very nice for me, but not for Robert. So I think that the sound system believes in free will up to a point, but of course Robert would say that was merely predetermined. So at any rate, we wanted to mention that. There are several things I want to mention. I think that once again, that Robert has mentioned he believes in general determinism, and yet within that he sees there's a room for choice, so he is not as deterministic as many determinists are. Now, he might disagree with that, but I think that certainly I found others who are much more cut and dried, and then again, we are basically cogs in a machine, if you will. So on that, I think we would both disagree with, but that's certainly the idea that sometimes can come across with these. The idea that he says that there is no reason to believe in a lack of determinism in the brain, that to me sounds like philosopher's language, if you'll pardon my saying so. But no, I mean, that's an argument from silence of the worst sort. There is no reason not to believe in a lack of determinism. This gets into verbal smog of the worst sort. But also, again, it just depends on how you argue things as to whether it's an argument from silence or an argument from fact. So I would mention that as a possibility. Now, I would also say that certainly with me, I do not believe in absolute free will, and certainly I would absolutely agree with Robert that there are things which cause that. He made a remark about my shirt. The cause for this was our Texas summer, and I said that I could have worn something formal, but I believe firmly that there is a difference between discipline and masochism, so I decided to wear a comfortable shirt and go with that. So there was a cause there, and yet I believe that there are choices, and especially gets into the realm of ethics, where our choices do make a difference. I would just mention one. Tomorrow I'll be teaching a study at the church where I'm the organist about Abraham, the time that he's decided that if he was going to have children, he had best take a concubine and go that particular route, and lo and behold, all sorts of trouble came out of it, because later on, when he had a child by his wife, full wife, concubines were regarded as half-wives, they got at each other's throats, and of course, there you see the mess in the Middle East today, from a very disastrous choice. Sometimes people have said, as a theist, do you think people in heaven know what's going on earth? I said, I hope not. At least not fully, because Abraham would be completely bald from pulling his hair out by the roots, seeing the results of the choice that he had made at that particular point. Also, if all of us are merely part of a genetic scheme that's continuing to work out on a deterministic problem, what do we do about people like Hitler and like Stalin? Were they merely, cogs in the machine doing what they were programmed to do? Or did they make some very dreadful choices there that really have affected the fate of quite literally millions? Now, of course, we all know about Hitler's getting rid of the 6 million Jews in Eastern Europe, but by the same token, Stalin told Winston Churchill that he authorized the slaughter of 10 million Siberian peasants for rebelling against the collectivization of their farms. So again, I think if we completely do away with the idea of free will, even within limits, then consequently we have no reason why we should punish people like Hitler or Stalin or those who take that particular attitude. So that would be my attitude there, and also I would say I think I thought about some of the flaws I can see in an argument for determinism. And by the way, I thought I talked fast. Okay, bye. Yeah.
I'm going to time it now.
All right. If I did, it's not my fault. Okay, so I don't think that we're actually disagreeing about a certain class of things. Of course we make choices. Actually, I don't think that there's been a philosopher, a philosopher alive that I've known about who says we don't make choices. The question is whether or not those choices are caused by prior events, and whether that in some way erodes the responsibility that we have for having made those choices. That's the issue. You know, I can hypnotize somebody to make a choice, right? I can hypnotize somebody to go and stab somebody. And our intuition is, you know, if in fact hypnotism is, you know, a real phenomenon, our intuition is that it's the person who hypnotized him that actually is responsible for the stabbing, not the guy who was hypnotized, even if it seemed to the guy who was doing the stabbing that he was making a choice, right? Because ultimately, he was just a bullet in a gun. He was making a choice, but that choice was prefigured by something prior to him, and that kind of robbed him of responsibility. So I'm not denying that we make choices. I don't think that anybody denies it. I just think that that doesn't give us free will in the sense it gives us moral responsibility or the thing that, you know, deserves praise or blame. That being said, I do think that we should take responsibility for our actions. I also think that we should punish criminals. I think that we should have systems of laws. Why? Because for the same reason that you would actually put a rabid dog into a cage. Right? We don't think the rabid dog has free will and was deliberating and saying, my goodness, I'm going to eat this child, right? No, we're actually removing it from society so it doesn't harm anybody, right? In some sense, we don't think that children have the sort of deep free will that we expect people to have because they don't really know enough. So what do? We do punish them, but we punish them to educate them. My position is consistent with all of these reasons for punishment, right? It's consistent with reasons for punishing and reasons for treating people such that you actually lead to changes in their behavior. Because what you're going to be doing is you're going to be adding yet another cause to their behavior, which is what determinism allows for, right? But punishment becomes behavior modification as opposed to being something that's based upon revenge. And to me, actually, that doesn't sound like something that's such a bad thing. So my view is not inconsistent with punishment. I can say that Stalin and Hitler made choices and bad ones. I can think that they deserve anything that you name, right? It's just, except for maybe hell. That would be the only thing that I don't think that my notion of free will allow for. About the argument from silence, you know, I mean, the fact that actually we have the same sorts of cells in our brains that are everywhere else, and actually they don't appear to violate the laws of nature, I don't know whether that's an argument from silence or not, but it seems like extremely good reason to believe that basically they behave in the same sort of fashion that everything else does. All of our evidence points to it. So, you know, if you think that's an argument from silence, that's fine. I think it's how scientists decide.
Actually, it was more your sentence I disagreed with. I would penalize some of my students for writing a sentence like that.
Yeah. Oh, well, all right then.
It was pink.
I got off lucky somehow. I think that the fact that actually, you know, neuroscience suggests there's laws of neuroscience and our brains operate by them is suggestive. I also think that one last thing. I think the fact that actually we deviate from traditions doesn't show a whole lot, right? I mean, there's reasons why people deviate from traditions. If I take two twins, even identical twins, and I whisper in the ear of one, I'm going to kill you and eat your bones, and then I walk away, right? That kid is going to act different than his brother, right? He's going to act significantly different, and those sorts of things ripple pretty far down the line. And I think that the differences between people are easily explainable, not only by the differences that actually we have inside us, which are pretty substantial, but really significant differences about the influences that we have and things like that. I mean, if you take two identical balls and drop them in pachinko machines, right? Pachinko machines are the thing with nails where you drop balls and they sort into little categories. It would be a really unfun game if it always went into one particular, you know, it's not a fun game anyway, but it would be a really unfun game if basically every time you dropped it in, it would go into one little hole. But it doesn't. It goes into many despite the fact that the balls are exactly the same. Why? Because there's slight differences in the circumstances of their dropping that lead them to deviate and wind up on opposite ends of the machine, right? That's all that's happening here. It's not a sign that there's some sort of magical free will. It's just a sign that basically small differences in circumstances can produce pretty large differences in the way that we live our lives. So.
Well, according to the timeline, the debate timeline, we now have some time for what's said to be open panel discussion, and then we get to statements and Q&As. So we're going to have plenty of time for Q&As.
But I guess maybe what we were thinking is that I would ask a few questions of each side just to see how the discussion will go further. So let me just pose one question to each of you, if you don't mind. Maybe I'll put this down a little bit. Okay. So can I ask Bruce to say a little bit more about the point that Robert was making, that if determinism is false, it just seems like what we have in human decision making is randomness. That I remember, because I've taught this, that one of my students once put it this way, and I hope I don't insult anybody by using this example, but she said, if there were just randomness, then it would be as though people had Tourette's syndrome. Like that there would be some behavior that would happen, right, but that it would be random, and that doesn't seem like it would be a free choice. It doesn't seem like a free choice. It just seems like something spasmodic or something that would happen to me. So could you say more about how, if there isn't determinism, that doesn't just mean that there are random sorts of events that would be as if there were spasms going on in our musculature?
Yes, this, I think, ties in with my idea that there are limits to our free will. I am not an absolute free will person because society has a way of imposing restraints. Robert has mentioned that, like with the rabid dog, that we put them away. We can do this with rabid people as well. You see, that sort of thing. But, and I certainly would agree with Robert that we do have things that lead us to make choices, but sometimes the reactions vary. Now, for instance, he mentioned that twins might have a different background because one had experienced something, this person that says, I'm going to eat your bones, this sort of thing, and the other one had not. Absolutely, and we are, to a sense, the product of some of the things that happened to us, but we also can react as to how that's going to affect us. Carl Menninger, many of you are acquainted with his name, he was, of course, the head of the Menninger Institute in Topeka, Kansas, but a very noted psychologist. He had a book called Whatever Happened to Sin, which sounds terribly out of fashion nowadays, but he said that he had found that people who were playing the blame game, what he finally got them to admit their own share, and by the way, he did not deny that we'd been victimized, all of us have been, you know, but he said at places where they had actually played along with it, he said when they began to come to terms with that and admit that they had a share in this, that is when they began to improve. So I'm saying the reaction, again, does have something to do with it. I would certainly agree with what Steve said, that if life was completely random, it would be a completely bonkers universe that I wouldn't want to be in. And likewise, the fact that our brain cells seem to be like other cells and react in a certain way, that's right, and yet by the same token, it the absolute determinism, which Robert does not hold to, although he might think he does, but would say that we don't really have any choice in the matter. But as he said, he believes that we do have choices there, and sometimes the choices can be startling to those around us. I won't get into personal witness there, but I've made a few choices that startled quite a few people as well, because they didn't think it was there, but it was. Okay, does this give you a little more to chew on there? Did I answer your question?
Yeah.
Okay.
Can you hand the mic back? Just pull it off the stand.
Oh, okay. Wasn't sure we could do that. There we go.
Feeling.
I'm free will.
I get one of these in my hands and I just put out. Sorry. But you two guys will have to decide what the causes for that. So let me ask.
But you got, I kind of like that. Push your point a little bit more. Should we think like?
Yeah.
So when you're saying, so follow up on Steve's follow up to my point. When you're saying that we react differently, okay. So that reaction is something that happens, right? Does that have a cause?
Yes. I mean, I think we have. Maybe the reaction itself does not. Okay. Sorry. I would say that sometimes it does. Well, there may be reasons if we react abnormally. There may be a reason for that in the past. But we also have the choice not to do that. For instance, I know that one of my friends got upset once when he and his wife were visiting me in Scotland, and he was driving too fast, and I told him to slow down, and he exploded. Well, you see, I happened to know his father, who was always ringmaster, taskmaster, whatever you want to call him. His mother's maiden name was LeGree, I think. So Ken was not hearing me. He was hearing his father at that point.
But now, once I didn't tell him that, but once he realized that, then I think he would be able to react differently the next time I did that. Because, again, of course, had he gotten tickets, you know who would have been gotten it in the neck there, me, because I didn't warn him. So I think that once we realize where something is coming from, we can change our reaction. That's what I'm saying there.
And then that's cause. That changes cause.
Yes, I think once we do that, because we can react in a normal fashion or what is regarded as an acceptable fashion rather than an unacceptable fashion. It's hard to say, no, I do not have dentures, but to try to act like it. We react in an unacceptable situation, sometimes because of where we come from, but once we know that, we can change things. That's what I'm saying.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Okay.
I just think that actually that itself is cause. So I think that basically it's still the case that basically the initial events determine what you're going to do.
But so reactions can be different. Yes.
Right. The same thing's true of molecules when they put in different solutions, right? Okay. So.
I have a question for Robert now. I'm thinking about punishment, for example, and you were saying that makes sense. Even given what you're saying, it makes sense. And I think you compared it to, well, you said it was a form of behavior modification. And I think you may also have said that we do similar kinds of behavior modification, say, with animals. And I guess what I understand a lot of people on Bruce's side think is that but surely there's something different about these two kinds of phenomena. Like that one, that there's something different and assumes something different about human beings when we punish them than that we're shaping their behavior in the same way that dogs get shaped, or their behavior gets shaped by, let's say, you know, a newspaper rolled up with them. That there seems to be, or it would only make sense for there to be a difference in between what we do with human beings and what we do with animals, and that seems to rest on some notion of free will, or do you think they really are fundamentally the same kinds of what should we say structures of behaviors?
So that's a good question. I think that they are basically the same thing. It's just that we're a lot more complicated than dogs. I think that we actually are extremely sophisticated creatures, and this makes the case that, like, if you just beat us with a newspaper, you're not going to get what you want, and you can actually fine-tune things a little better. Now, that being said, I actually do think that there are things out of punishment that we're not going to get, and that we think we are, that we kind of intuitively want. So, I would make a distinction between punishment that is justified by what it's going to do to the future, like either prevent this person from doing it again, or maybe reform them, or just take them out of commission, or deter other people. Right? There's punishment that's actually justified by that sort of forward-looking consideration. And then there's the punishment that is not justified by that, but it's justified by just like how they did it, and they're guilty, and they deserve it. Right? I actually think that last bit is what you can't get, and is not justified given my particular view. So I'm going to kind of agree and disagree. I do think that there are some things that you're not going to get on my view, but actually, I think that you get enormously sophisticated differences between us and punishment of dogs, on that view.
I think, according to the schedule, maybe what I should do now is to let each of you say a few kind of summarizing remarks, if you don't mind, and then we can move on to questions from the audience that I'll try to moderate. So, Bruce, would you like to summarize?
I think I've probably said it pretty thoroughly. It's just that I do believe that our choices matter. I think we've made that clear. It's obvious with some of the things that have come out of this that Robert and I are not perhaps as far apart when it comes to push coming to shove, everyday behavior, as one might think. But certainly, I've seen people make terrible decisions, and then with the blame game, that is bad news to me. But when you see people who are really trying to make sense out of life and making decisions after having thought things through and try to work with it, people like that I could work with anytime and have a great deal of respect for. I certainly have no right to go pushing my views on people like that. I've chosen decision places like this because you can disagree with people without people getting terribly upset, at least usually, I'll say that. Now, if Robert wants to be wrong, that's his problem. Seriously. But I enjoy this type of thing very, very thoroughly, getting into discussions, and as mentioned, this is something that's been haunting people for centuries, and I seriously doubt that on a hot July evening in Dallas, Texas, we're going to solve all the problems to everyone's satisfaction. But I think my choices matter, and I want to make sure I make the right ones and think them through until I can. That's me.
Well, so I agree that our choices matter and they have consequences, right? In fact, that's part of determinism, is that basically there's a causal structure of the world, not part of it, right? So I believe that our choices matter and that they have repercussions. I also believe that you can't just, like, sit back. My view doesn't have the consequence that you can just sit back and wait for things to unfold. I can't just sit back in bed and be like, I would really like an omelet this morning. I really hope it was prefigured a million years ago in the universe that I was going to get an omelet this morning. Let's just wait and see. At least in my house, I'm not going to get an omelet if I do that, right? Because the world is also causally structured in such a way that I got to get out of bed and make the omelet if I'm going to get the omelet. So I'm not saying you have to just kind of like do nothing or anything like that. Our choices matter, right? And I don't think you should act like they don't. I just think that at the end of the day, they are prefigured in the structure of the universe in such a way that an outside observer, say you're God watching it unfold, watching a murderer murder somebody, God would have to look to Gabriel and say, that poor guy didn't have a chance. And Gabriel would have to say, no shit, nobody had a chance. Determinism is true. That's all my guess.
Great. Thank you. I think now we move on to the question. Wow, a lot of questions. I'm not sure who this is directed to. It says, would B.F. Skinner recognize the argumentum ad hominem as invalid, or is logic merely honky human grammar? Yeah, I'm not sure who this is.
I think that's you.
Oh, well, actually... okay.
I think probably it's tricky guessing that Professor Skinner would say that logic argued ad hominem shows the fact that we need to modify human behavior to where the logic changes, or at least to where people use better logic, this sort of thing. So perhaps he would say that the very fact of the way we are using logic shows limitations that need to be improved. How does that sound to you, Robert?
Sounds good to me.
Okay. It's got to be right. Yeah, I say it.
Okay. This one is for Robert Howell. Do you think that because our brains obey physical cause and effect relations, that means that the results of an enormously long stream of conscious are ultimately, an enormously long stream of consciousness are ultimately predictable? Is this not freely running thought that involves free choices? So I guess the question is a very long and surprising thoughts that we may have really predictable.
So I think that's an excellent question. So it depends on the level predictable. I don't think we can predict them, because I actually think that we don't know enough about what's going on typically to make those predictions. And you know, we may not get to the point where we will know until we actually get a lot smarter about neuroscience and things like that. Are they predictable in the sense that in principle they follow from the laws of nature, and in principle they follow from what happened before you started deliberating? Yes, I do think so. That being said, I think that the fact that I think it's probably a very valuable fact that we're ignorant about some of the stuff under the hood. Right? I think that it's probably quite good that we don't think of ourselves as automatons, even though we are.
I'm reminded of what Immanuel Kant said, that again, that all we can see are the phenomena, and really getting to the noumenal, the very essence of things, that the human mind is incapable really of perceiving that, and I think that would be a set of line there, and it might be extremely comfortable that that's the case.
Okay, Bruce, I have one for you. How does the gift of God provide us with free will? When in human evolution did animals get free will and become humans?
I could really play the chicken there, better a smart chicken than a dead duck, and say, that's not my field of expertise. I honestly don't know about the timings and this and that, but certainly there does seem to come a time, and it's interesting to see that so many cultures had the idea of a primal couple making a choice that affected the rest of us. I mean, you think about Greek mythology with the story of Pandora's box, you see. Once again, she and her playmate, not in the Hugh Hefner sense, but in the true sense of the word there, Epimetheus, they make a terrible decision that affects the rest of the world, and yet there are so many cultures like that. As to say the timing and how that works out, I don't know. But I do believe that, once again, there is the idea that we can make decisions that are either very good or very ghastly. And I think, again, as Robert has mentioned too, sometimes the motivation is important. As you say, that God can say, that poor person never had a chance. Some people have it rough there. There's no question about it. But some people have all the choices and still deliberately make the worst ones there. One of my friends in Scotland actually told her about that. And she made a bad decision, and it took her a while to really try to unravel that, you see. Now, she was able to do it, but said that there came a time when she knew she was making a wrong decision. Socrates had trouble with that, but she did it anyway. And she, of course, she did have some reasons. She said, well, she wanted to do it, but the reasons were not as good as the reasons for making the right decision. And later she came to admit that.
And I like this one because somebody is familiar with some philosophical terminology that hasn't really been used yet. So I'll let Robert take this one. It says, I have heard the phrases hard determinism and soft determinism. How would our panelists differentiate the two?
So actually, I don't particularly care for those labels in some ways. But I mean, typically what they mean is something like this. The soft determinists and the hard determinists both believe that determinism is true, in that all events are caused and unfold from a million years ago, all that nonsense, right? What the hard determinist says, and that's me, basically says, that provides a real deep threat to free will, something that we really want, to more responsibility. The soft determinist, which, you know, it's kind of a, you know, the wishy-washy determinist, right? The wishy-washy determinist says, well, despite the fact that everything is caused, there's still free will, there's still moral responsibility. These guys are oftentimes called compatibilists because they believe that free will is compatible with determinism. And we didn't get into that, but actually I would say that the majority of philosophers writing today are compatibilists, I would say. So, sort of popular, sorry. I'm working on it.
You tell about a person who was a hard determinist who fell down a flight of stairs and he believed he was a theist. He looked up and says, boy, I'm glad that's over with. That's hard.
There's another question I just realized that sort of follows this one that I'll take as having been answered. Can you explain the compatibility position regarding free will and determinism?
Well, I don't know that I can explain, but I mentioned this position. Do you want to say anything more? Well, actually, I kind of want to get a little clear. Would you consider yourself a compatibilist, or would you consider yourself, I mean, do you think determinism is true in the sense that basically from a million years ago, everything followed?
Here we get into the difference that Aristotle brings up between potentiality and actuality. So I would say...
Did you just use me as philosophical terminology?
Absolutely. But potential, the idea that it can happen. But it does. I don't think it necessarily follows through. I do not believe that the two are completely compatible, and that consequently I get into double talk very easily. But I firmly believe that there are limits to how far we can go, or whatever, but within that we are, our decisions do make a decided difference, and we cannot blame it on the devil or Officer Krupke or whoever. So when people start saying that really divine election, this is Calvinism, and free will really work together very well, I have unkind remarks written in the margin of the books that say things like that. So subtlety is not my strong point. I think you can figure that.
Okay. This has two questions. One is directed at Pro. I think that means you.
I think so.
You're Pro. Does God know everything? And if so, do we have no choice?
This is something I've dealt with many times, so I'm on familiar turf here. Programming is one thing. Foreknowledge is something else. Now, I know that if I were, don't worry, Steve, if I were to reach over and punch Steve in the nose, I know it's going to hurt like blazes, and he's going to say, what'd you do that for? You see, but that doesn't mean I programmed him to do it. You see what I mean? So I believe God for those things, that he knows what a person of my sort is going to do in a situation, but he doesn't program me any more than I would program Steve to react violently in doing something like that. Now, one of my former parishioners who was in the National Guard was serving up in Greenland, and there was a guy there that was very jumpy, and if you got behind him and yelled, he would automatically turn around and punch you. And the thing is, if you were leaning against a pole, a metal pole, he would turn around and punch the pole. They saw him do that, and he would really break his hand. They would do it 5 minutes later, and he did the same thing again. It was just a reaction, but they knew he would do it. They didn't program him to do it there. So I think there's a difference between foreknowledge and programming. And yes, God knows what people like us will do in certain situations, but I don't think we are automatically programmed by him, that sort of thing. That's me.
Okay, this is for the con.
I get negative.
I get con. The con man, yes. We've kind of touched on this, but I'll ask it. Why do we have a judicial system that punishes us if it's not our own choice?
Yeah, I think that, the determinists believe that basically causes have effects. So particular things that you do are going to have certain effects. Actually, one thing that has an effect is telling people that you're going to punish them and doing it. Right? It has an effect to actually cause people, when they're considering whether or not to commit a crime, they actually say, now I don't really like to be in prison, and I don't really like, you know, to be killed, and so I'm not going to do it. Right? That's actually not only consistent with my view. My view actually explains it quite well. If it turned out, actually, that our choices were not determined by characters, in fact, weren't determined at all, then you might wonder why we didn't have a judicial system, because our punishing people wouldn't deter anybody, because at the end of the day, it would be a matter of some sort of a random event whether or not they, you know, committed a crime again. Right? Actually, I think that determinism is most consistent with our judicial system, because what we want to do is we want to basically look forward and reduce harm and provide all sorts of incentives and extra causes in your sort of, you know, repertoire of causes so that you behave better. And I think that that's, you know, that's what we should do, and I think it's very consistent. In fact,
I think, again, he's touched on something there. He says that basically also punishment is meant to be, at least for society, educational, to show people why this sort of stuff doesn't work there. And also, I think early he touched on something very good. He says if our desire is to protect society, we'll probably get it. But if it's just to say revenge, boy, this guy's going to get it, blah, blah, blah. We're not liable not to get what we want. I heard about a woman traveling with four small children on a train in England, and they were acting up, and finally she gave one of them a spanking, and a woman across the aisle glared at her and says, haven't you ever heard of the psychological method? And the woman with the children said, yes, but this is quicker. So.
Okay, thank you. This one is a kind of has a number of parts. Let me just read the beginning, and then I'll kind of present the questions for each of you. It says, are you familiar with the Global Consciousness Project and the PAIR Project, capital P-E-A-R? And if so, could you give a brief explanation of them? And let me just add one other thing. It says, it's interesting that neither of you mentioned God. Well, I think that's not true. I think God was mentioned. But what is God's role in free will, or is there no role for God? In other words, God's plan for me. What is the role of God's plan for me? So I'll let each of you say what you want about those questions.
Why don't you start out with here and global consciousness there? Because I know those only by name.
Well, you're actually doing better than me. Even though consciousness is kind of my field, this is something I'm not familiar with. Whoever wrote that question, I would certainly welcome you to come up and talk to me afterwards and educate me about it. I'd be interested in what these things are. So do you want to talk about the G?
Yeah. I think, once again, as I say, God was not mentioned. I, again, wanted to soft pedal that. But definitely as a theist and as a practicing Christian, I think that that God has given us plans, but I think that he has limited himself. I say he because that is the traditional language. I do not believe that God is exclusively masculine. But that's been traditional, so I'll stick with that. Less confusing, perhaps, at this point. But I think that, again, God is in the business of self-limitation there to give us some genuine room for action there, and that our choices do make a difference. And when we have done something well, then we find, of course, the statement in Scripture there about well done, good and faithful servant. So I think that, yes, I think there's been a bit of self-limitation on the part of God so that we do have some choice to make some genuine choices at that point, and that they do matter.
Thanks. This one's from Robert. How can you prove that everything is caused? In other words, prove cause and effect in every single case.
So this is the nifty thing about my position, actually, is that I don't think you can prove that everything is caused. I think that's one of the, I mean, that's really very difficult to prove, right? But the nifty thing about my position is that either a particular event is caused or it's not. Either way, you're screwed. Because if everything is caused, then basically you have a problem with determinism. If basically an event is uncaused, then you didn't cause it. So you can't be held responsible for it. Basically, the point is that even if it turns out that I'm wrong about determinism and there's a sprinkling of randomness in the universe, that actually deteriorates, that actually works against human action. And actually the moral responsibility associated with human action as opposed to working with it. So I think that there's good reason to be very confident that the things that are happening on the neural level, on the level of psychology, are, as a matter of fact, law-like, and therefore deterministic. But, you know, I think you should be humble, but if you sprinkle a little randomness in there, I don't think it's going to help us in this particular issue at all. In fact, I think it's going to make our plight worse.
Along that same line, I would say, too, that there is the idea that, he says, it's the neat thing about determinism that we can't figure this out. I think that that again shows up Kant's idea that we cannot really fully understand the structure of things because our mind has its limitations. That, I think, is good because even in theological circles, we find people trying to figure out God's eternal will, etc., etc., and we just can't do it because our mind and our, so much our lot now, our experience is not up to that. So we have to realize, I think, our limitations at that point. And it's very comforting when we do that and stop trying to figure out the riddles of the universe that are just beyond us.
Bruce, this one's for you. Is the problem of evil resolved if we assume that God has given man free will? What else could explain an omnipotent and omnibenevolent being allowing all the pain and suffering on the earth?
Yes, I think if we take this speak from a theological viewpoint, once again, if everything that happens is the will of God, and I don't believe that it is, and you better believe that some people would absolutely rise up in the air and wobble around for my saying that, but I don't believe that everything that happens is the will of God. If it were, then we would have to lay everything at his door. I have heard people say things at funeral homes. Now, God just loved your little girl better than you did, so he drowned her a wee bit and took her on. Strong argument for justifiable homicide, and that is when I say the formerly red hair begins to show up. You know, people say these dreadful things, and yet they are convinced that they are saying a theologically accurate thing. If I were to say what I really believed at that point, they would be totally horrified. Then my Calvinist friend in Scotland that I mentioned, he says, well, if I didn't believe that everything that happened was the will of God, I would think that was virtual atheism. And I'm well, I disagree at that point, you see. So again, I'm full-fledged Wesley at that point. So I believe that the fact that God has given us some rope means that there are times so we can hang ourselves. And unfortunately, in the case of people like Hitler or Stalin, get a little bit closer to home, Jeffrey Dahmer and Charles Manson, they hang some other people along with them. So, and yet, that's better than saying that we, I mean, this is not against Robert, your position, but the idea that God will take us only if we are robots and can do no other, this sort of thing.
This one, I believe, is directed at Robert. Was it determined at the Big Bang that you would teach philosophy in 2011 and attend a debate at SMU on July 26th, 2011? I guess this is a yes or no question.
Yes. Well, so actually, I mean, I think that I mean, so I think that you should be more subtle than that. I mean, I think that, I mean, looks likely, but I think that the physicists are finding quantum determinacy. So I do think that actually the world does turn out to be probabilistic at its base, if the scientists are right about that. And if that's true, then basically that's going to bubble up every once in a while. Statistically, it's extremely unlikely to bubble up to big events like the moving of a watch hand on a watch. And that's a huge event in comparison to quantum processes. But like every once in a while, we're talking about the history of the universe here, it's going to bubble up. And so, you know, it's entirely likely, I think, that quantum determinacy has bubbled up enough times at the beginning of the universe to actually throw some things in an unpredictable fashion from the initial Big Bang. I don't think that helps your goal a whole lot, but...
Interesting to see that C.S. Lewis took some of the same argument there in his book on miracles, saying that they were built into the beginning process based on God's foreknowledge, there we go again, and that therefore miracles do not take God by surprise because he knew they were going to be there from the beginning. So it's interesting to see that there is some similarity in the argument there at that point, although the ground is completely different.
Okay, I guess he's next to Villier for Robert, the con man. I think I'm just summarizing because there are a number of questions on this, but it says, not everything is caused. There is just as much irrationality as rationality. You can't predict what I will do in the future, presumably because of some kind of irrational thing that I might do. What is your response to that?
Actually, my response to that is kind of get them run. That sounds a little ominous. So basically, my view doesn't require that, I definitely don't think everything is rational in the sense that basically all the things we do are a result of sort of rational decisions. In fact, a lot of people think that the worst threat of determinism comes from the fact that, you know, sometimes things kind of impinge upon irrationality and lead us to do irrational things. Some of what's unpredictable about our behavior results from the fact that chemical and non-conscious things begin to interfere in our behavior and actually lead us to do things that we wouldn't otherwise do. Right? And depression, for example, is a result of, to a large degree, a decrease of serotonin in the synapses. And if basically we don't know about that, which we wouldn't know about looking at one another, we might all of a sudden say, why is she not leaving her room? Why is this otherwise motivated person not doing her homework anymore? Why is she not getting out of bed? Right, that lack of predictability is a lack of predictability according to her rational goals and that sort of thing. But it's not a lack of predictability according to the actual physical system that she is. And all I'm maintaining is that when you take it all into account, we are going to get that sort of predictability, even if some of that behavior turns out to be irrational outcomes.
I think you would also say that part of our job is to find out what is causing the irrationality and to deal with it so that it won't happen again.
Okay, here's another question from someone who knows some philosophy. There are a number of phrases here, but I think maybe the most interesting one is the mention of Buridan's ass, which I take it is raised...
Is that what I'm going to be called next?
It might have been directed at me. I take it that the question is kind of about sort of ties, or when both options, or a number of options, are all... equally attractive. Don't people have... So I take it the question is, if, let's say, I'm standing in a basket at Robin's and there are a lot of flavors I like, don't I have some kind of freedom to choose one rather than another?
I don't know why I'd be a real person.
So, this is an interesting issue because, it's clear that we're not just locked in paralysis when two options that appear equal before us. And we do want to make some choices. I think that if they really do appear equal to us, that choice is going to be irrational, if not irrational. But one thing that's kind of interesting is that the choices to hit the right button or the left button in the experiments I mentioned look like pretty good cases where there's no good reason to do one or the other. Right? And yet, those conscious decisions can actually be traced back to prior neural events, right, that were in some cases, seconds before the awareness makes a decision. Now, what was going on that actually led to choosing one or the other? I don't know. Actually, I think a lot of science would have to be done before we know. But I do know this. Either it was caused or it wasn't. If it was caused, we're back in the determinist news. If it wasn't, we just got randomness. We don't really have the free will that we want.
You want to ask the follow-up?
That was the first thing to ask, guys. You know, I asked between the two emails, but my client was aware of that. Of course, the client's took into account what Arizona said. Client said, the good thing we have spectacles on, space time that goes out. And you don't know we have them on, you can't take them off. So that explains the story. Heavens above and the moral order within. Just hit and wake it from the domain slumber. For Copelston's history of philosophy. Putting this in that context, you said an action, it seems to me an action might be what's made by the mind, rather than by the brain. Maybe the mind, I think of Alan Planting, Descartes, you know, it could be that, and the dialogue between Hylas and Philip Nunes, Bishop Berkeley had, it could be that instead of the mind in the brain is in the mind. It could be the mind causes human action,
it
makes the brain tell the finger to pull the
trigger.
Well, let's see. That's what you're doing. That's what you're doing. So, yeah, I mean, I think the world would be very surprisingly weird if that turned out to be the case. But that's okay. One of the things about this view is, even though I'm talking in terms of the brain and, you know, maybe just a modicum of scientific respectability by doing so, my view doesn't depend upon that. So let's just talk about a dualistic mind, a soul, right? The problem's still the same. Either basically what the soul did when it made a choice was caused or it wasn't. If it was caused, right, then we're back into the determinist thing. If it wasn't, then basically it was a random event, the soul didn't cause it, and therefore the soul can be held responsible. So it's not a matter really of whether it's the mind or the brain, it's a question about whether or not there's causes. You're begging the question. You're a little bit
surprised.
Assuming what was given proven. Notice by saying, well, maybe I should ask, what is your definition of the word action? Please explain what you mean by the word action.
So there's actually an entire field of philosophy dedicated to that, answer that question. but I mean, you know, I think that probably actions are, events that are causally connected to motives and reasons in a certain way, and they've got to be correctly causally connected. The full story, I don't know, actually Steve knows a lot more about this than I do, but so, you know, for example, I'm here sort of raising my arm by Tourette's is not an action, but my decision to pick up my iPhone is an action, not because it's free, but because the causal connection went through my motives and my sort of reasoning process. So that's what makes the difference between an action and a reflex.
I think there's a problem, too, with the idea that it's either this or that. It reflects the idea that we want quick answers today because we live in the age of the microwave oven. And there's, you know, our answers are 15 seconds or less. But life doesn't really work that way. And also, I think that it's either hardcore determinism or hardcore randomness. I think that that overlooks the fact that there's a huge spectrum in between those two extremes with all sorts of people that fall somewhere along the spectrum, some closer to one than the other. So again, there's a compatibility or whatever, compatibilism, things like that. But still, there is a wide spectrum between those two blunt-stated extremes. But again, it's one of those things where we're not going to get an easy answer. It doesn't work that way.
There actually is, this is really out of order. There's a question here for me. The moderate, shouldn't happen. I'm thinking also on the schedule here that there is a little time for a closing statement. So, Bob Cooper, I'd be happy to answer your question, but it seems like it's not my show tonight, and I should let Bruce and Robert each other.
I mean, I've been thinking that. Do you feel like we need to?
Well, I think we basically made clear what I think anyway. How about you?
Yeah, and I think a third summary proposition.
I've got everybody thoroughly confused, so I'll stop there.
I'd be happy to continue the discussion. I think that's pretty fruitful.
Okay.
We've got like 5 minutes. Over you take one more question.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
Okay. Well, I mean, if there's 5 minutes. it's directed at, it says Dr. Steve, which is how I go at SMU, because you can't
exist Swerdlick.
Swerdlick is just, you have to give people a workaround for that kind of thing. A name. So it says, Dr. Steve, given your research interest in punishment and tonight's topic, can you blame me? We are interested in just what your research has revealed. And then says Bob Cooper, in other words, blame the researcher. Rogers, I guess it's me. It was very interesting to hear some of what was said about punishment, because I am working on that now. I find it very interesting. I have to say, I'm closer to Robert's position than to Bruce's about the general philosophy of this. It does seem to be true, and people have pointed this out at least back to the time of Hobbes, around 1660, that even if determinism is true, he thought punishment made sense, and in fact, this was one of the central functions of the state. He thought it prevented the war against all, and punishment could be effective, because punishment is just an example of causation on human beings, causing them to obey the law. What I find interesting is the question of whether these different sort of approaches or different goals to punishment would make sense if determinism is true. It seems like deterrence or the threat component of punishment would be perfectly acceptable and legitimate and workable, even if determinism is true. Also, what they call incapacitation seems to be perfectly legitimate and possible. You just would be able to stop people from committing crimes by using completely causal and deterministic mechanisms. The things that interest me are the ones that are sort of more elusive. There is this kind of retributivist idea that just goes something like, well, we'll punish you because you did something bad, and evil deserves a kind of response, a sort of tit-for-tat kind of an idea. I do find that not only morally kind of offensive, but I also find that sort of harder to defend or understand if determinism is true, and I think it may well be true. The goal of punishment I'm most interested in these days is what's called reform, and that I find to be a rather tricky issue. I'm sort of working on that now and trying to think about it. Is that a legitimate function? Would it make sense if determinism is true? Part of the reason I'm interested in that particular thing myself is that people think of reform, or they tend to think of reform, as kind of a moral change, like that you become morally virtuous or morally good. And I'm not convinced that's even the law's business, that I become morally good. It may just be the law's business, so to speak, that I obey the law for some reason or other. Like for any particular motive, it seems as though the law is perfectly okay with that. Like the law doesn't say to me, you have to obey the law because it's the right thing to do. As far as the law is concerned, if I obey the law because I'm afraid of being punished, that's okay. You know, the law is perfectly okay with that. And so I'm interested myself in whether reform is a really legitimate aim of punishment. And it may be that it won't make sense if determinism is true. And then the punishment would rest on a kind of a smaller base, a smaller moral base, perhaps.
Two more questions. A lady here with a pretty colored skirt, and a gentleman back here.
We have about 2 minutes.
We started a little late. I think we can last a few
two more minutes, so we'll...
Okay.
The lady down here was first, I think.
I don't know if I'm a gentleman, but... I was curious, you,
Dr. Steve.
Interested in reform and that kind of thing, are aware that the word penitentiary,
yes,
dealt with in the early 19th century with the reform movement. The idea was not just to punish the prisoner, but to make them up that person, and that's what they had. Lots of people along back then even thought maybe that was kind of sad. And a lot of course, people always see the idea now. That the current imagine that maybe it's all the paper, but I was also curious whether both of you gentlemen would think about compatibility in the following sense. A lot of times you will be admitting that yes, people are influenced by various things that limit the choices they therefore will make, which does seem to be somewhat determinist, and yet you, allegedly a hard determinist, are frequently saying, well, I'm very much for punishment and that sort of thing, because you need to alter people's choices, except when you're using the word choice, gee, that sounds very free willish to me. So, I mean, it seems like a compatibilist method is the only way to even resolve the language you're supposed to use in the field.
Steve, I'll turn your mic on. Just go ahead. Don't let the others answer this one. I had to hear that question. Comments,
well, I do want to actually respond to that last bit.
Yeah, there's, I think if there's a sense of choice, that might mean that it was uncaused. There are no choices in that sense, in my view. If they are, they're not the sort of thing that gives us responsibility, because they're uncaused, so I didn't cause them. There are choices in the sense that basically there are reactions to circumstances that lead to actions, and those reactions to circumstances proceed through our rational deliberation. That's a completely determinative causal process, but still a choice, in a certain sense. If you don't want to call it a choice, that's fine. I'll call it a schmoice. I think one of the things that these experiments kind of show is that that sort of thing is not inconsistent with there being causal predeterminants.
Briefly, very briefly, we have one more question. I would say yes, that my doctoral work was actually on a very difficult passage in 1 Corinthians, in which Paul told the Corinthians something about an offender. I said, the Corinthians knew what Paul meant, and we don't, and that's what we get from reading someone else's mail. But by the same token, the offender was to be punished, but the early church fathers generally took the view that it was going to be for remedial purposes, reform, that it was meant to bring the person to, in this case, his senses, so that again, he would straighten up and fly right. So from the time of Origen of Alexandria on, that seems to have been the basic thrust. So the idea of a time of what you said, sir, about penitentiary coming from being penitent and cleaning up your act.
One more question. A lady in the back.
The right crowd. All right.
I'm not a philosopher, okay, so I'll explain.
Go ahead,
Matt. But in chaos theory, they talk a lot about the butterfly effect, and not butterfly classes things in Los Angeles creating a tidal wave in Asia. How does that fit in with determinism?
That's not a really easy question to answer. So
you're a good philosopher.
I don't think that alone is inconsistent with determinism. That just shows that actually big changes can result from small effects. But it's still the case that basically a small effect, big changes come from small causes. The small cause, the finding of butterfly's wings, so is deterministically connected to the big event. Now, there's other uses of this butterfly effect which actually do involve indeterminacy, like on a level, and about that, I kind of already said that I think that those things can follow up, but I think that basically the phenomenon, which I think probably is very real, that small causes have big effects, is pretty consistent with my view, and actually leads to a certain level of unpredictability in the world, even though determinism is true.
Bruce? Just saying again, the idea that small choices seem to get involved is like, again, the story of Abraham taking the concubine and not realizing the terrible mess in the Middle East that had come from that decision. So that's why I say, be careful how we make what seems to be a small choice, because it may have some tidal wave results.
I want to
thank you all.
Let's give a round of applause for our panel. Now I'd like to introduce David Drum, president of Dallas Philosophers Forum, to conclude this debate.
I'd just like to thank our audience as well as our panelists for your attendance and your attention tonight, and just point out that this is a good example of the kind of thing we try to promote at the Dallas Philosophers Forum. We are a nonprofit, all-volunteer organization, and as Bruce pointed out, we try to create the environment where people can really look at the contrast, the differences, the clash of ideas, but do it kind of in a non-personal, conflict way, sort of disagree without being disagreeable, I guess, as it's sometimes said, and I think we've achieved that tonight. So thanks to everybody involved, and we hope this will whet your appetite for more of the same in the form of our